the necroscope, plainly angry now, cut in.
Or trying to. And of me. He's on my back, Darcy, and he sticks like glue. He's tried to get into my mind, but so far I've kept him out. Only that takes effort, gets tiring, and I'm getting pissed off, exerting so much effort on something like this. On some sneaky little bastard who's doing someone else's dirty work.
For a moment, Clark's mind was full of confusion, but he knew that to hesitate would only make him look suspect. "What do you want me to do?" he said.
"Find out who's running him, of course,"
Harry snapped.
"And why?"
"I'll do what I can."
"Do better than that,"
Harry came back like a shot.
"Or I'll have to do it myself."
"Why haven't you already?" Clark wondered. "Are you afraid of Paxton, Harry? And if so, why?" "I've told you he isn't one of mine," he said out loud. "Now that's the truth, so you can't threaten me through him. But like I said, I'll do what I can." There was a pause, then...
"And you'll get the details of those girls to me. That's a promise."
"Okay." The necroscope's voice had slackened a little, lost some of its tension.
I didn't mean to come on so strong, Darcy."
Clark's heart at once went out to him. "Harry, I think you've a lot on your mind. Maybe we can speak sometime in person, I mean. What I'm saying is, don't be afraid to come to me."
"Afraid?"
It had been the wrong word. "Apprehensive, then. I mean, don't worry that there might be something you can't tell me or we can't talk about. There isn't anything you can't tell me, Harry." Again that long, perhaps indistinctive pause, then...
"But right now I don't have anything to tell you, Darcy. However, I'll get back to you if ever I do."
"Is that a promise?"
"Yes, that's a promise, too. And Darcy, thanks."
Clark sat and thought about it for long minutes, and while he sat there behind his desk, drumming his fingers in a continuous, monotonous tattoo, he became aware of the first small warning bells growing to an incessant clamour at the back of his mind. Harry Keogh had required him to find out who was running Paxton, but who could be running him if not E Branch, and to what end? The last man to occupy this desk had been Norman Harold Wellesley, a traitor. Wellesley had gone now, dead, but the fact that he'd ever existed at all, and in this of all jobs, must have caused ructions further up the line. What? A double agent? A spy amongst mind spies? Something which must never be allowed to happen again, obviously. But how to stop it from happening again? Could it be that someone had been appointed to watch the Watchers? It reminded Clark of a ditty his mother used to say to him when he was small and had an itch. She would find the spot and scratch it, reciting, "Big fleas have little fleas upon their backs to bite them. The little fleas have smaller fleas, and so ad infinitum." Was Clark himself under Esper scrutiny? And if so, what had been read from his mind? He got onto the switchboard, said, "Get me the minister responsible. If he's not available, leave a message that he's to call me back soonest. Also, I'd like someone to run me off a duplicate set of police reports on those girls in that serial killer case." Half an hour later, the reports were delivered to him, and as he was putting them in a large envelope, he got his call from the minister.
"Yes, Clark?"
"Sir," he said, "I just had Harry Keogh on the phone."
"Oh?"
"He asked for a set of reports on the girls in the serial killer case. As you'll recall, we asked for his help on that."
"I recall that you asked for his help, but in fact I'm not so sure it was a good idea. Indeed, I think it's time to rethink our attitude towards Keogh."
"Oh?"
"Yes, I know he's been of some assistance to the branch and..."
"Some?" Clark had to cut in. "Some assistance? We were all gone as long ago without him. We can't ever repay him. Not just us, but everyone. And I do mean everyone."
"Things change, Clark,"
said the unseen, unknown other.
"You people are a weird lot, no offence. And Keogh has to be the weirdest of all. Also, he's not really one of you. So as of now, I want you to avoid contact with him. But we'll talk about him again, I'm sure, later."
The warning bells rang even louder. Talking to the minister responsible was always like talking to a very smooth robot. But this time, he was just too smooth. "And the police reports, does he get them?"
I think not. Let's just for the moment keep him at arm's length, right?
Is there something to worry about, maybe? Clark came straight out with it. Do you think perhaps we should watch him?
Why, you surprise me,
said the other, smooth as ever.
It was my understanding that Keogh had always been a good friend of yours.
He has.
Well, and doubtless that was of value at the time. But as I said, things change. I will get back to you about him, one way or the other, in good time. But until then, was there anything else?
One small thing. Clark kept his tone neutral but scowled at the phone. About Paxton. It was a leaf straight out of Harry Keogh's book, and it worked just as well for Clark.
Paxton?
He actually heard the minister catch his breath. Then, more cautiously, perhaps curiously,
Paxton? But we're no longer interested in him, are we?
It's just that I was reading through his records, Clark lied. His progress reports, you know, and it seemed to me we'd lost a good one there. Is it possible you may have been a bit too thorough? A shame to lose him if there's a chance we can bring him on. We really can't afford to waste talents like his.
Clark,
the minister sighed,
you have your side of the job and I have mine. And I don't question your decisions, do I?
Don't you?
And I really would appreciate it if you wouldn't question mine. Forget about Paxton. He's out of it.
As you wish. But I think I'll at least keep an eye on him, if only from a distance. After all, we're not the only ones in the mind spy game. I'd hate it if he were recruited by the other side. The minister was getting peeved.
For the moment, you have quite enough work on your plate,
he snapped.
Leave Paxton to me. A periodic check will suffice, when I say so.
Clark was only polite when people were polite to him. He was far too important to let himself be stepped on. Keep your shirt on, sir, he growled. Anything I say or do is in the branch's best interest, believe me, even when I step on toes.
Of course,
the other was at once conciliatory.
But we're all in the same boat, Clark, and none of us knows everything. So for the time being, let's just trust each other, all right?
Oh, yeah, let's, sure. Fine, Clark said. I'm sorry I've taken up so much of your time.
That's all right. We'll be speaking again soon, I'm sure.
Clark put the phone down and continued to scowl at it a while, then sealed the envelope containing the police reports and scrawled Harry Keogh's address on it. He erased his and Keogh's recent conversation, then asked the switchboard if they'd trace the call. They had, and it was Harry's Edinburgh number. He phoned it direct, but got no answer. And finally, he called a courier into his office and gave him the envelope. Post it, please, he said. But before the courier could leave, no, repackage the whole thing and send it off special delivery, and then forget you ever saw it, right? In a little while he was alone with his dark, suspicious thoughts again, and an itch between his shoulder blades, which he couldn't quite get at, and his mother's ditty about fleas, which was equally persistent. Chapter 3. Changeling. Harry Keogh Necroscope didn't know Darcy Clark's ditty, but he did have a flea on his back. Several, in fact, they were biting him. Geoffrey Paxton was the only one, and probably the least of them, but because he was reachable and immediate, he was the most frightening. Harry wasn't frightened of Paxton, rather of what he might do to Paxton if he lost control, and of what losing control might conceivably do to him, to the necroscope inside him. He knew how easy it would be to betray himself and reveal that he was no longer an innocent, but that some great and as yet undeveloped, but developing certainly, darkness had entered him. That was what Paxton was looking for, Harry knew. Proof that the necroscope was no longer a fit citizen or habitant of Earth, no longer indeed a man, not entirely, but an alien creature and a monstrous threat. And when he knew it for sure, when there was no longer any doubt, then Paxton would report that fact and there would be war. Harry Keogh versus the rest of mankind. And that was the last thing Harry wanted, to be at odds with a world and its peoples, which he had fought so long and so hard to keep safe. Paxton then was a flea on Harry's back, a niggle at the edge of, attempting to dig its way deeper into, his mind. An irritation. And because Paxton's presence was representative of an even greater threat, which must ultimately challenge the necroscope's very existence, it was something Harry could well do without. For the Vampiri, the single honourable answer to any challenge may only be written in blood. Vampiri. The word itself was a power. It was a tingling in the core of his being, an awareness of passions beyond the feeble, fumbling emotions of men, a savage, explosive, nucleic energy contained, but barely, in his seething blood. It was a chain reaction which was happening to him even now, whose catalyst was blood, and in itself it too was a challenge, but one which he must resist, which he must not, dare not answer. Not if he desired to remain ascendant and for the most part human. A flea, then, this Paxton, an invader who would stick his proboscis in the most private and inviolable of all human territories, the mind itself, and siphon out its thoughts. A spy, a thought thief, a parasite come to sup up Harry's secrets, a flea. And only one flea of several, and not one which he could afford to scratch. Another unbearable itch was the fact that the dead, the great majority of mankind, who yet lay apart from the unknowable to mankind, with the soul, exception of Harry Keogh, were withdrawing from him. He was losing his rapport. The change in him had wrought a change in them. Their trust was weakening. Oh, there were many among them who owed him beyond their means to repay, and many more who loved him for his sake, to whom the necroscope had always been the one glimmer of light in an otherwise everlasting darkness. But even these were wary of him now, for when he had been simply Harry, unsullied and unsullying, innocent and gentle, why, then it had been a marvellous thing that he could touch the dead, and they touch him. But all that was yesterday. And now that he was more than Harry, there are certain things which even dead men fear, and limits to what they will lie still for. Since the destruction of Janus Ferenczi and his works, Harry had been busy. Other than the constant irritation of Geoffrey Paxton, the only intrusion he'd allowed, a single distraction from his purpose because he had no control over it, was the knowledge that a necromancer lived and practised his abominations in England. It distracted him because Penny Sanderson was now his friend, his ward even, and because he was privy to what she and the others like her had gone through. Of the fact that the forces of law and order would track down and apprehend Penny's torturer, murderer, and then violator eventually, Harry had little doubt. But they would never charge him with the full range of his offences, because they had no yardstick by which to measure them. They neither knew nor were capable of defining a full range of offences, not in this case, and certainly there was no punishment which would fit the crime, not in law. But the necroscope fully understood the nature of this beast and his crimes, and his ideas of punishment were rather more stringent. Even before his contamination he'd had that. It was a flame which had been sparked in him by the murder of his own sweet mother, and which burnt just as lively to this day. An eye for an eye. As to what Harry had been doing since removing the last of the Ferenczis forever from the world of men, his works had been weird and wonderful, and the thoughts in his Mobius mind even more so. To begin with, he brought back Trevor Jordan's ashes from Rhodes. The incorporeal telepath had wished it. Death might have something of meaning with Harry to talk to, but not even Jordan had suspected Harry's real purpose. By themselves, however, the essential salts of a man were insufficient to put Harry's plan into action, not and achieve the entirely satisfactory result he sought, which was why, before further reducing the ruins of Janus Ferenczi's castle, the necroscope had removed from them certain chemical substances by means of which Janus had performed his own monstrous brand of necromancy. Not all of the dead would wish for such a resurgence, Harry knew. The Thracian warrior king, Bodrock, and his wife, Sophia, whose world had lain 2,000 years in the past, had been happy to collapse in each other's arms and return to dust, a merciful release for them who had prayed for it so often. But what of the much more recently dead, like Trevor Jordan, for instance? The answer might seem easy. Why not ask him? But in fact, that was the hardest thing of all. I intend to return you to life. I have the apparatus, but I'm not 100% sure of the system. It worked perfectly well for another, but he had the advantage of many hundreds of years of experimentation. In the event all goes well, you will be as you were, except, well, you'll recall that you did put a bullet through your brain. I'm not entirely sure how that will affect you. If when I call you up from your ashes and I discover you're a complete gibbering fucking idiot, then, however reluctantly, I'll be obliged to put you down again. Now, provided you're perfectly happy with all this, or in Penny Sanderson's case, Penny, I think I can bring you back. But if I get the mixture wrong, it could be that you'll not be as lovely as you were. I mean, your skin and features could be imperfect, or blemished, or pocked hideously. For example, some of the things I called up in the Castle Firenze were quite monstrous. There were depletions, inconsistencies, anomalies. Wherefore, I reserve the right to erase you if things go wrong. But of course, we'll always be able to try again later, when, with a bit of luck, I'll get it right. No, he couldn't tell them what he had in mind, not yet. If he gave them the bare bones of the thing, they'd require him to flesh it out, and if he elaborated, they'd fret about every smallest detail. And from now until the actual resurrection, they'd mix anticipation with dread, alternating shivers of excitement with shudders of terror most extreme. They'd climb high mountains of hope, only to tumble back into the black lakes of deepest despair and depression. I have a shot which may cure your cancer, but it just might give you AIDS. That was how it would feel to Harry if the roles were reversed. But at the same time he knew that of course it wasn't like that. When you're dead, you're beyond hope, and so any hope has to be better than none. Or does it? Or was that simply the vampire in him? Tenacity aspiring to immortality, doing his thinking for him. Or perhaps he hesitated for another, far more elemental reason. Something that warned him that with his small talents, small, yes, in the scale of a universe or parallel multiverses, he must not, dare not, usurp one of the greater talents of that other whom men call God. History's necromancers, among which Janus had been a latecomer, had dared it. And where were they now? Had there been avenging angels before Harry, to put right the wrongs of these wizards? And if so, would there be one after him, to chastise him in his turn? Harry had been the necroscope, was becoming a vampire, and now would be a necromancer in his own right. How dare he seek out Penny's murderer to punish him on the one hand, and on the other pursue the practice of that same black art? What would be his punishment? Perhaps the gears were already engaged, the wheels even now turning. Perhaps the necromancer had already gone too far, disturbing the delicate balance between good and evil to such an extent that it now required radical readjustment. Had he simply become too powerful, which is to say, corrupt? How did the old saying go? Absolute power corrupts absolutely. Ridiculous. Was God himself corrupt? No, for the maxim of men are like their laws. They apply only to men. Such arguments were endless in the metamorphoses of the necroscope's mind and body, until sometimes he thought he was mad. But when his thoughts were clear, he knew that he was not mad. It was just the thing that was in him, altering his perception along with everything else. And then he would remember how he used to be, determined that he must always be that way, and know that he only hesitated out of consideration for his friends among the dead. It was simply that he didn't want Trevor and Penny to suffer agonies of protracted uncertainty, only to let them down when the waiting was over. To die once is enough, as had been made perfectly plain by Janus's many Thracian thralls in the bowels of the Castle Firenze. As for God, If there was such a one, and Harry had never been sure, then the necroscope supposed he must consider his talents God-given and use them accordingly, while he could. Harry had spent a good deal of time arguing, not least with himself. If a subject took his fancy, almost any subject, he would play word games with himself to the point of distraction and delirium, a sort of mental masturbation. But it wasn't just himself he was jerking off. In conversations with the dead, he was equally argumentative, even when he suspected that they were right and he was wrong. Indeed, he seemed to argue for the sake of it, out of sheer contrariness. He thought and argued about God, also about good and evil, about science, pseudoscience, and sorcery, their similarities, discrepancies, and ambiguities. Space, time, and space-time fascinated him, and especially mathematics with its inalienable laws and pure logic. The very changelessness of math was a constant joy and relief to the necroscope's challenging mind in its changeling body. Within a day or two of returning from the Greek islands, he had used the instantaneous medium of the Möbius Continuum to go to Leipzig and speak to August Ferdinand Möbius, where he lay in his grave there. Möbius had been and still was a great mathematician and astronomer. Indeed, he was the man whose genius had saved Harry's life on several occasions, again through the medium of his Möbius Continuum. But while Harry's primary purpose in visiting Möbius was to thank him for the return of his numeracy, instead he ended up arguing with him. The great man had happened to mention that his next project would be to measure space, and as soon as the necroscope heard this, he threw himself headlong into an argument. This time the argument was space, time, light, and the multiverses.
"Won't universe suffice?"
Möbius had wanted to know.
"Not at all," Harry had answered, "because we know there are parallels. I visited one, remember?"
And East German students with their notebooks had wondered at this particular man who stood by a dead scientist's tomb muttering to himself. Möbius had been logical about it.
"Very well, then. Let's concentrate on the one we know best. This one."
"You'll measure it?"
"I propose to."
"But since it's constantly expanding, how will you go about it?"
"I shall stand at its outermost rim, beyond which there is nothing, transfer myself instantaneously through the universe to the far rim, beyond which there is likewise nothing, and in so doing measure the distance between them. Then I shall transfer myself instantaneously back here and perform the same experiment exactly 1 hour later, and again 1 hour after that."
"Good," Harry had answered. "But to what purpose?"
"Why, from that time forward, and whenever I require to know it, a correct calculation of the size of the universe will be instantly available."
Harry had stayed grudgingly silent for a moment until, "I too have given the matter a little thought," he said, "though purely on the theoretical level, because the physical measurements of a constantly changing quantity seems rather fruitless to me, whereas to understand what is happening, how and to what degree the age of the universe is tied to its rate of expansion, a constant, incidentally, and so forth, seems so much more satisfying." An astonished pause.
"Oh, indeed?"
And Harry had almost been able to see Möbius's eyebrows joining in a frown across the bridge of his nose.
"You have thought about it, have you? Theoretically, you say? And might I inquire as to your conclusions?"
"You want to know all about space, time, light, and the multiverses?"
"If you've the time for it."
Möbius had been scathing in his sarcasm, to which the necroscope had answered, "Your initial measurement will suffice. No other is necessary. Knowing the size of the universe, and not only this one, incidentally, but all the parallels too, at any given moment of time, will automatically know their exact age and rate of expansion, which will be uniform for all of them."
"Explain."
"Now the theory," said Harry. "In the beginning there was nothing. Came the primal light, possibly it shone out of the Möbius Continuum, or perhaps it came from the colossal fireball of the Big Bang. but it was the beginning of the universe of light. Before the light there was nothing, and after there was a universe expanding at the speed of light.
Eh?
Do you disagree?
The universe was expanding at the speed of light?
Actually, at twice the speed of light, said Harry. That was the essence of your problem, remember, which sparked the return of my numeracy. Switch on a light in space and a pair of observers 186,000 miles away from it on the opposite sides would both see its light 1 second later, because the light expands in both directions. Now do you disagree?
Of course not. The primal light, as any light, must have expanded just as you say. But the universe?
At the same speed, said Harry. And it still is expanding at that speed.
Explain and make it good.
Before the light, there was nothing, no universe.
Agreed.
Does anything travel faster than light?
No, yes. We can only be in the Möbius continuum. But I suppose thought is likewise instantaneous.
Now think, said Harry. The primal light is still travelling outwards, expanding on all frontiers at a constant speed of 186,000 miles per second. Tell me, does anything lie beyond those frontiers? And I do mean anything.
Of course not, because in the physical universe nothing travels faster than light.
Exactly. Wherefore light defines the extent, the size of the universe. That's why I call it the universe of light. A formula. The age of the universe is equal to its radius divided by the speed of light. Do you disagree? Möbius had looked at the thing scrawled on the screen of Harry's mind.
The age of the universe is equal to its radius divided by the speed of light.
And after a moment, but very quietly now,
yes, I agree.
It's hard to get a decent argument going these days. Everyone cries uncle. Möbius had been angry. He had never seen Harry like this before. Certainly the necroscope's indistinctive math was a wonderful thing, an awesome talent in its own right. But where was Harry's humility? What on earth had got into him? Perhaps Möbius should let him continue to expound and then try to pick holes, bring him down a peg or two.
And time? And the multiverses?
But Harry had been ready for him. The space-time universe, which has the same size and age as all the parallels, is cone-shaped, the point of the cone being the Big Bang primal light, where time began, and the base being its current boundary or diameter. Is that feasible? Logical? Desperately seeking errors, still Möbius had been unable to discover them.
Yes,
he was obliged to answer eventually.
Feasible? Logical? But not necessarily correct.
Grant me feasible, said Harry. And then tell me, what lies outside the cone?
Nothing, since the universe is contained within it.
Wrong. The parallels are cone-shaped too, born at the same time and expanding from the same source. Möbius had pictured it.
But then, each cone is in contact with a number of other cones. Is there evidence of this?
Black holes, said Harry at once, which juggle with matter and so perform a necessary balancing act. They suck matter out of the universes, which are too heavy, into universes, which are too light. White holes are, of course, the other ends of the black holes. In space-time, such holes are the lines of contact between cones, but in space they are simply, a shrug, holes. Möbius was tired, but
cones are circular in cross-section,
he argued.
But three together, and you get a triangular shape between them.
And Harry then nodded his agreement. Grey holes. They're the ones at the bottom of the Perchosk Ravine, and another up an underground river in Romania. And so he'd made his point and won his argument, if there had been one to win in the first place. For the fact was, he'd only argued for the sake of it and neither knew nor cared if he was right or wrong. But Möbius had cared, because he didn't know if Harry was right or wrong either. Another time the necroscope had talked to Pythagoras. Again, his principal reason for going to see him was to convey his thanks. The great Greek mystic and mathematician had been of some assistance in his quest for numeracy. But again the visit had ended in an argument. Harry had thought to find the Greek grave at Metapontum, or if not there, then at Crotona, in southern Italy. But all he found was a follower or two until, by pure chance, he stumbled upon the forgotten 2,480-year-old tomb of a member of the Pythagorean Brotherhood on the island of Chios. There was no marker. It was a stony, ochre place where goats ate thistles not 50 yards from a rocky shore looking north on the Aegean.
Pythagoras? No, not here,
that one informed in a hushed and very secretive manner when Harry's deadspeak broke into his centuried thoughts.
He's elsewhere, waiting out his time.
His time?
Until his metempsychosis into a living, breathing man.
But do you converse? Are you able to contact him?
He will occasionally contact us when a thought has occurred to him.
Us?
The Brotherhood. But I have said too much. Begone. Leave me in peace.
As you wish, Harry had told him. But he won't thank you that you turned away a necroscope.
What? A necroscope?
Astonishment and awe.
You are that one who taught the dead to speak out in their graves, so enabling them to talk to one another as in life?
The same.
And do you seek to learn from Pythagoras?
I seek to instruct him.
That is blasphemy.
Blasphemy? Harry had raised an eyebrow. And is Pythagoras a god, then? If so, a painfully slow one. Consider this. I've already achieved my metempsychosis. Even now, I embark upon a second phase, a new condition.
Your soul is in progress of migration.
I may say that a change is in the offing, certainly. And after a while,
if I speak to our master Pythagoras on your behalf, if you have lied to me, be sure he will damn you with numbers, I and possibly me with you. No, I dare not. First prove yourself.
Harry had contained his impatience as best he could. Perhaps I can show you some numbers. As a member of the Brotherhood, I'm sure you will appreciate their importance.
Do you seek to seduce me with your puny figures? What, the work of a mere lifetime? Are you suggesting that in the 2,000 years or more which have passed since I was laid to rest here, I've dreamed no numbers or equations or formula of my own? Necroscope or none, you are presumptuous.
Presumptuous? Harry's anger had been aroused.
Equations, formula? Why, have formula such as you could never dream.
And he displayed the computer screen of his mind and covered it with the endless mutating algebraics of Möbius mathematics. Then he'd formed a Möbius door and let the other gaze a moment upon the nowhere and everywhere across the threshold, until gaspingly,
"What? What is that?"
"The big zero," Harry had growled then, letting the door close on itself. "The place where all numbers begin. But I'm wasting my time. I came to talk to a master and ended up chatting with a mere student, and a middling one at that. Now tell me, do I get my audience with Pythagoras, or don't I?"
He is in Samos.
Where he was born?
The same. The last place anyone would think to look for him, he thought.
And then frantically,
"Necroscope, plead with him for me. I have betrayed him. He will exclude me."
"Rubbish," Harry had growled, but without scorn. "Exclude you? He will elevate you, for you have gazed upon the secret mathematical door to all times and places." "You don't believe me?" And he'd shrugged. "Well, it's your choice. My thanks anyway, and farewell." And conjuring another Möbius door, he stepped through it, and out again on Samos, 20 miles away, where Pythagoras had spent his childhood 2.5 millennia ago, and to which his bones had been returned in secrecy when at last he died. Pythagoras, however, introvert, secretive, diffident, could hardly escape or ignore the necroscope's deadspeak probe at such close range. That thought in itself had been deadspeak, and as such the recluse, in death even more than in life, had heard it, and answered,
"What is your number?"
Harry had shrugged, homing in on the mystic's mental whisper. "Any you choose for me." And when he located him definitely, one further Möbius jump took him from a deserted, wooded shoreline straight there, to a small olive grove on a terraced hillside above a headland with a tiny white church. Down the coast a little, scarcely glimpsed through the pines and wind-warped oaks, Tegane's harbour, glinted turquoise, blue, silver. Music from a taverna came drifting on the bright summer air. It was cool in the shade of the trees, and the necroscope had been grateful to take off his wide-brimmed hat, also the dark-lensed spectacles which protected his now delicate eyes. And because Pythagoras had remained silently thoughtful,
"There are numbers galore. I'm not fussy."
"Then you should be."
The mystic's whisper was tremulous, fevered.
"They are the All. The gods themselves are numbers, though no man knows them. When I have discovered the numbers of the gods, then my metempsychosis may commence."
"If you truly believe that, then you've a long time to wait," Harry had answered at once. "You can know all the numbers in all their combinations from now to eternity, and it won't change anything, not for you. It isn't a magical thing, Pythagoras. However many numbers you employ, your soul won't fly into a new body. There's no science or sorcery can help you now."
"Ha!"
The other was filled with wrath and now a little scorn.
"Only see who utters these blasphemies. And is this the necroscope who was impotent and innumerate, to whom the simplest sum was a mystery? Are you the one they pleaded for, the legions of dust, the teeming dead? Mobius came to me on his knees for you, and what are you, after all, but an ingrate?"
Harry had been needled, but hid it from the Greek. Likewise, he hid his thoughts. Pompous old fart. While out loud, "I came to thank you for my numeracy. Without it, I'd be like you, dust in a grave, or perhaps not like you, but there was a man who would have called me up to torture me for my secrets."
"A necromancer?"
"Just so."
"It is a black art."
"Not always. It has its uses. What I'm doing now is a sort of necromancy after all, for I'm a living man talking to one who is dead." Pythagoras gave this a moment's thought, and,
"I overheard your conversation with one of the brothers," he said. "Is blasphemy your byword? You alleged reincarnation, transmigration, metempsychosis."
"I stated a fact," said Harry. "I was one man in his own body, and when it died, I inhabited another. Don't take my word for it, but ask the dead, who have nothing to gain from lying. They'll tell you it's true. Moreover, if your ashes were pure, I tell you I could even call you up from the dead. Not with numbers, but with words. And this isn't blasphemy, Pythagoras, but simple truth. Or perhaps the act itself could constitute blasphemy. I can't be sure. If so, then you're right, and I'm a blasphemer, and plan to be again."
"You could call me up from my ashes?"
"Only if they were pure, unsullied. Were you buried in a jar?"
"I'm buried in soil, in secret, here beneath your feet, where as a boy I ran among the trees. My flesh and bones are now one with the earth. Anyway, I cannot believe you. Words are not numbers. Words are from the lips, frivolous things which are spoken and change, while numbers spring from pure mind and are immutable."
Harry had shrugged. "It's academic, after all. In 2,000 years, your salts have been washed into the soil. There are no words, and certainly no numbers, which can help you now."
"Blasphemy and sedition! Do you seek to turn my followers against me?"
Harry could contain himself no longer. "Pythagoras, you're a charlatan. In your world, you guarded your small, pointless mathematical secrets, basic discoveries which any child under instruction knows today from his schoolbooks, as if they were life and death. And true death has not changed you. I gave you dead speak, since when you could have conferred with more modern, more genuine masters, if you'd wished it. To Galileo Galilei, Isaac Newton, Albert Einstein, to Romer, Maxwell, and..."
"Enough!"
The other had been outraged.
"I should have ignored Mobius. I should have..."
"But you couldn't ignore him," Harry turned to cut in. "You dared not."
"What do you mean?"
"That I know your real secret, that you were a fraud, but that you not only made fools of your precious brotherhood in life, but continue to deceive them in death. There is no mysticism in numbers, Pythagoras, and you must know it, if only because you're a learned man. Why, you yourself have told me that numbers are immutable, unchanging, and unchangeable, which means that they are solid truth, not flights of fancy.
iron truth, not ethereal magic. Liar! Liar! Pythagoras had raged. You twist words, change meanings. Why do you hide yourself even from the dead?
Because they have no understanding, because their ignorance is contagious.
No, because they know more than you. Your followers would desert you. You told them they would migrate, return again to men, and meet with you in worlds of pure numbers, and now you know this was false.
I thought it was true.
But that was 2,500 years ago. And are you returned? How long does it take to admit you are wrong?
I have dreamed of numbers that would blast you.
Blast me, then. By this time, Pythagoras had been sobbing. He hurled a catalogue of numbers at Harry, which shattered against the wall of the necroscope's metaphysical mind. But at least they shocked him into recognition of his predicament, that again the thing inside was striving to replace him, this time by use of convoluted vampiric logic. On this occasion, it was his salvation, for it had never been Harry's desire to hurt or even harm the dead. And I'm sorry, he said.
Sorry? You are a fiend,
Pythagoras had sobbed.
But you are right.
No, I merely argued. Perhaps I am right, perhaps not. But I was wrong to argue for the sake of it, and let's face it, I stand in contradiction to my own argument.
How so?
I know the numbers are not immutable.
Ah!
A long-drawn-out sigh.
Would you? Could you demonstrate?
At which Harry had shown him the screen of his mind, with all of the Mobius's configurations crawling on its surface, mutating and sprawling into infinity. And for a long time, the old Greek had been silent. Then,
I was a clever child who thought he knew everything,
he said, his voice broken.
Time has passed me by.
But it will never forget you, Harry had been quick to point out. We remember your theorems. Books have been written about you. There are Pythagoreans even today.
My theorem? My numbers? If I hadn't done it, others would have.
But it's your name we remember. And anyway, that could be said of anyone and anything.
Except the necroscope.
But I'm not even sure about that, Harry had answered. I think that perhaps there were others before me, and certainly there was one after me. They dwell in other worlds now.
And will you dwell there too?
Possibly, probably, and perhaps soon.
What's it like now?
Pythagoras had asked after a while, and Harry had suspected it was the first thing he'd inquired of anyone in a long time. Upon this island, the necroscope had answered, lie many of the more recently dead. But you've shunned them. You could have asked them about Samos, the world, the living, but you were afraid to know the truth. And do you know, the last thing of any importance to the living on this island is number. Well, perhaps not entirely true. I'm sure they're interested in the quantities of drachma to the pound, to the Deutschmark and to the dollar. He explained his meaning.
The world is so small now.
Harry had put on his hat, his glasses, and gone out from the shade into the sunlight. With his hands in his pockets, the latter didn't bother him too much, but he must go slowly or lose his balance on the rough tracks and roads into Degani. Pythagoras had gone with him, his dead speak anyway. Distance wasn't too important once contact had been established.
I'll open up the Brotherhood, dissolve it entirely, put it aside. There is much to learn.
Men have landed on the moon, said Harry. Pythagoras's mind had flown in circles. They have calculated the speed of light. The old mystic's thoughts were one huge, astonished question mark. But you know, among the dead are those mathematicians who could benefit greatly from your knowledge.
What? Mine? I am an infant.
Not a bit of it. You stuck to pure number. Why, in 2,000 or more years, by now, you're a lightning calculator. May I test you?
By all means, but please, a simple thing, not the dizzy designs inscribed upon your secret mind.
Then give me the sum of all the numbers between 1 and 100 inclusive.
5,050.
Pythagoras' answer had been instantaneous. Harry had been right. A lightning calculator. Among the less practical mathematicians, the theoretical mathematicians, why, you'd be like a talking slide rule. I think that for a dead man you've a great future, Pythagoras. The Greek had been flattered.
But it was such a simple thing, and known by heart. Multiplication, division, addition, and subtraction, aye, and trigonometry too. I've done it all so often. There isn't an angle I can't calculate.
Harry had smiled. There you are, and however dryly. Believe me, there aren't many today who know all the angles.
And you, Harry, are you a lightning calculator?
Harry hadn't wished to shatter him. Ah, but with me it's different, intuitive.
Between one and a million, then?
500,500,000, the necroscope had answered, almost in the same breath. Take 10 and multiply it by itself as many times as you like, and it works every time. Half of 10 is 5, put the two halves together again, 55. Half 150, put the halves together, 5,050, and so on. Magic to some, intuition to me. Pythagoras had been downcast.
Why would they need me when they already have you?
Because, as I've stated, I may not be here too long. It's like you said, the world is a small place and it's hard to find a hiding place. On the outskirts of Degani, he'd found a small taverna and seated himself in its shade and ordered ouzo and a dash of lemonade. English girls splashed in the warm blue waters of a small rocky bay. Their breasts were shiny, and Harry could smell the oil of coconut from here. Pythagoras had picked the picture from Harry's mind and scowled at it.
Perhaps it's as well I'm unbodied to stay,
he'd commented darkly.
Like vampires, they deplete a man.
For a moment, the necroscope had been caught off guard, but then... Ah, he answered. But there are vampires, and there are vampires. Chapter 4. Someone Dying. The necroscope's vampire, as yet a mere tadpole of alien parasitic contamination, was immature. As such, it had no desire for conflict, either internal or external, but wished only to evolve and get on with the long process of its host's conversion, which was why its influence was mainly enervating. Keep Harry mentally and emotionally drained, and he'd be less likely to jeopardize himself, which by definition meant that he'd be less likely to jeopardize his horrific tenant. Hence his flashes of vampiric awareness, half-glimpsed knowledge of burgeoning, ungovernable power, and the burning need to argue and cross-examine, even to engage his own mind in long spells of intense self-inquisition, despite the bouts of inwardly directed anger and mental exhaustion which invariably resulted. But quite apart from the necroscope's mind, his blood was also aware that the invader was there. It seemed filled with a weird psychic fever which kept him jumpy and constantly on guard. He was a man with a volcano inside him, which for now merely simmered and let off a little steam. Not knowing when the volcano was set to go off, he couldn't relax but must hold the cap firmly in place and listen with a rapt, horrified and yet curious intentness to the rumbling within. On the one hand, Harry would like to test out his vampiric talents to the full, for they were part of him even now, while yet the physical side of the thing was still embryonic. But on the other hand, he knew that to do so would be to accelerate the process, for one thing was certain. However immature his symbiont might be, it was also fast growing and learning. No slow starter, this vampire. But while the parasite, like all its kind, would be dodged, the necroscope was no less tenacious in his own right. His son had managed to keep his vampire in order, hadn't he? His son, like father, Harry would do his damnedest to follow suit. Except that would be hard enough in itself without the current recalcitrance of the great majority, and the knowledge, or at least strong suspicion, that E-Branch was gearing itself up for war, and the fact that despite all of this, Harry had determined to bring a certain fiend to justice, but first must find him. Previously, he would have been able to work out a logical system of approach, like writing down an itinerary of priorities, but his mental confusion and the weariness it produced obfuscated, so that while he was aware of the passage of time and of force mobilizing against him, still he felt incapable of rising above and proceeding beyond his personal miasma, which in turn brought frustration, more anger, and the first gale warnings that his whirling, gusting emotions craved physical release. Like an alien autism incapable of self-expression, Harry could feel his violence lying just beneath the surface. His violence, yes, for the vampire in him was neither violent nor emotional. It merely amplified these properties in its host. Perhaps most frustrating of all, he knew that none of the things he was doing, or would do, if he felt capable, was of the slightest importance to his own personal survival. Another in his position might seek to change his identity, find a safe place, extricate himself permanently from all dangerous sources and focuses. Or would he? Would he even be able to? For as Harry had pointed out to Pythagoras, the world is a small place, and, by definition, any other in Harry's position would likewise be vampiric and territorial. This was his world. This house, not far from Edinburgh, was his house. Especially his thoughts and actions were his territory, most of them, most of the time, at least when others weren't snooping on them. Yesterday he had gone to the ruins of the Castle Firenze and spoken to Bodrock the Thracian. Bodrock was too recent a friend to have known Harry before the start of his transition. He accepted him for what he was now. Also, Bodrock was fearless and in any case could not possibly fear the necroscope, nor for that matter any other living man. His dust and the dust of his wife Sophia were scattered to the winds, and only their spirits remained in the Carpathians now. They were quite beyond earthly harm. The subject of Harry's inquiry had been the composition and proportions of the chemical ingredients of Janus Ferenczi's necromantic potions. He would only retrieve Trevor Jordan and Penny Sanderson from their essential salts if he could bring them back perfect or as close as possible. Bodrock, because he had been subject to such experiments, was an authority. Even so, he'd inquired at length into the necroscope's purpose before passing on the necessary information. And so today, Harry had been ready to become a true necromancer in his own right, and would have proceeded. But at the last moment, he'd felt that twinge, that covert tweaking at the corner of his mind, which had warned him that Geoffrey Paxton was close by and watching him. Knowing that Paxton was seeking to prove just such an unnatural activity in him, Harry had been obliged to postpone the experiment, and then, barely able to control his rage, he'd spoken to Darcy Clark at E-Branch HQ. It had come as a relief to know that Paxton wasn't Darcy's man, but if not his, who? Maybe Darcy would find out and let him know, and maybe not. And in any case, what odds? For Harry knew that sooner or later Darcy and the others must all join forces against him. The hell of it was that the boss of E-Branch had been a good friend once. The necroscope couldn't see any way that he would ever be able to hurt Darcy, but how to explain that to the thing inside him? At 2 o'clock in the afternoon, Harry had sat quite still in his study and listened, but his vampire awareness was still a fledgling thing and he'd detected nothing. Or maybe he had. The very briefest wriggle of something on the outermost rim of his perceptions. Whatever, it was suspicious enough that he'd put back his experiment more yet, then rammed his wide-brimmed hat onto his head and gone outdoors to talk to his mother. Now sitting on the crumbling riverbank, Harry dangled his legs and looked down into the gently swirling water, which had been Mary Keogh's grave for most of his life, and let his dead-speak thoughts reach out to her. Since there was no one here to see him, he simply spoke to her, which was also dead-speak and felt far more natural. "Ma, I'm in a mess." If she'd answered, "So what's new?" he would understand. It seemed he was always in a mess. But Mary Keogh loved her son as all mothers do, and death had not diminished that.
"Harry?"
Her voice seemed very faint now, very distant, as if she'd been washed away downriver along with her physical shell.
"Oh, Harry, I know you are, son."
Well, and that was only to be expected. He'd never been able to hide anything from his ma, who had warned him often enough that there are some things you daren't get too close to. This time he'd let himself get too close. Do you know what I'm talking about?
"There's only one thing you can be talking about, son."
She sounded so sad, so sorry for him.
"And even if you hadn't come to speak to me, still I would know. All of us know, Harry."
He nodded. "They're not so keen to talk to me anymore," he said, maybe a little bitterly. "And yet I never harmed a single one of them."
"But you should try to understand, Harry,"
she was at pains to explain.
"The great majority were once living and now are dead. They remember what life was, and they know what death is. But they don't understand and wish nothing to do with anything that lies between. They can't understand something which preys on the living to make them undead, which takes away true life and replaces it with soulless greed and lust and evil. The children and grandchildren of the teeming dead are still in the world of the living, and so are you. And that's what worries them. It makes no difference how long people are dead, Harry. They still worry about their children. But you know that, son, don't you?"
Harry sighed. Her dead speak, however faint and possibly even chiding, was as warm as ever. It covered the necroscope like a blanket, kept him safe, made it easier to think and plan and even dream. It was so alien to the nightmare thing inside him that part of Harry could neither understand nor interfere with it. Namely, it was the love of his mother, soothing as nothing else could ever be. "But the point is," he said in a little while, "that I've one more thing to do before I'm finished here. And it's important, Ma, important to me, and to you and the teeming dead alike. There's a monster running loose, and I have to nail him."
"A monster, son?"
Her voice was very soft, but he knew what she meant. Who was he to talk about monsters? "Ma, I've done nothing wrong," he answered, "and so long as I'm me, I'm not going to."
"Harry," she said, "son, I'm all used up."
And she wasn't only faint, but very tired too.
"We're not inexhaustible. Left alone, we just go on thinking our thoughts, gradually fading as all things do. We do fade in the end, be it ever so long. But torn by outside influences, we go that much faster. I think that's how it works anyway. You were a light in our long night, son, and it was like we could see again. But now we have to let you go and suffer the darkness. Alive, we used to wonder, is anything on the other side? Well, there is. And then you came and joined us up, and there was a kind of life again. So now I wonder, what's next? What I'm telling you is I haven't long here, but I'd hate to leave you not knowing you were all right. What are your plans, Harry?"
And for the first time he realized that he really did need a plan, as simple as that. His mother had cut through all of his confusion. "Well, there's a place I can go," he finally answered. "Not much of a place, but better than dying, I think. And there's someone there who can teach me things, if he's willing. He had problems too, but the last time I saw him he was coping. Maybe he still is. Maybe I can learn something from him." She knew where, who, and what he meant, of course.
"But isn't that a sinister sort of place, Harry?"
He shrugged. "It was. Maybe it still is. But at least I won't be hunted there. I would be hunted here eventually if I stayed. which means I'd be forced to hunt too. And that's what I'm afraid of, and what I'm trying to avoid. I'm a plague in a bottle, Ma, safe only so long as no one shakes or tries to break me. But in that other place the plague has already run its course. What's unthinkable here is understood there. Not acceptable, never that, but a reality all the same. She sighed.
I'm glad you're not just giving in, son.
And with something of her old fondness.
You're a fighter, Harry. You always were.
I suppose I was, he agreed. But I can't fight here. That would only bring it on. And in the end, I'm afraid it might be stronger than me. There are still things I have to do here, that's all. Business that needs clearing up. Which is how I'll occupy myself until it's time. You asked about my plans. They're simple, really. When my head's on straight, I can read them like words in a book. There's a girl who died horribly and didn't deserve it, because no one deserves to die like that. And there's a creature who killed her, and other innocents like her, who does deserve it. There's a long talk, an explanation, which I owe to Darcy Clark, and oh, there are talents I'd like to gather, which might be useful to me in the other place. That's all of it. A few things to do, something I have to straighten out, and one or two new things to learn, and then it will be time I walked. I'd rather walk than be chased.
And you'll never come back?
I might if I learned how to hold the thing permanently in check. But if I can't, no, never.
How will you deal with this man, murderer, monster you're looking for?
As